Mayor Matthew of Long Beach, California.
Bill, you know, wire it up. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Matthew. I'm an alcoholic.
It's a privilege to be here. It really is. And thanks to Bill for inviting me and having dinner with my daughter and myself at the hotel. Brought my daughter Sophie. She's in the back of the room with headphones on watching a movie. She's never heard of the story, and I hope she never does. But we drove up from Long Beach together. I travel a lot for work, so I try to, when I can, bring somebody in the family along on these things. And it was just such a joy to drive 210 miles with a little person who's so present. You know, it just went by like that. Funny thing about doing this is I'm almost sure I'm going to fail. and I will. I'm not kidding. Because Alcoholics Anonymous means everything to me. You know, before I got here, I had nothing. I was less than nothing. I was a negative underground person, and now I have these things. I could tell you about this story. And like if you came to my house and you picked up anything and flipped it over, including my daughter, on the bottom it says Property of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I had nothing. And I got these gifts. But those things aren't what happens here. It's not what happened here to me. And that's what I mean. I'm going to fail. I'm humbled every time I get the chance to do this because I cannot tell you. I will not be able to tell you what's happened to me here. So I'm stuck with what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And hopefully from those clues and from your own experience, you can put together something that helps you help, like what helped me. You know, I have a spiritual connection that I didn't think was possible that I can't describe. So anyway, that's my disclaimer. My sobriety date is May 16th, 1993, and my home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, and it's on Monday nights at 8:30. So I want to talk about recovery. So I'll tell you about my first drink and my last drink, and then talk about what happened. I didn't drink a lot in high school. I didn't drink at all in high school when everybody else was drinking because in my family, I'm the youngest of four in an Irish Catholic family, and they weren't all drinkers. My mom and dad had one drink a night, you know, but my brother, I'm the youngest by 7 years. I always say, thank God the Catholics don't believe in birth control or I wouldn't be here. And they were all a year apart, and then, they do believe in guilt, however. So I got life, and then I got guilt. But my brother is just ahead of me, but he's 7 years ahead of me. Was a raging alcoholic from the time I was, nine. So I saw it, and I didn't want to do that to my family or my parents. I love my brother. I worship my brother. He played the drums. He looked like Paul McCartney. I thought he was a god, you know. And he was my older brother. He was how much cooler, you know. Could you be? And I remember I had the clear eyes of youth, and I would try to tell him, you know, maybe if you didn't drink all the time, and he would say, you don't understand. That's not the problem, you know. And anyway, so I didn't drink when everybody else did, but I went to a small Catholic school from first grade through high school. I hang out with the same six guys, and in my mind, and I've heard this a lot from podiums in AA, in my mind, they were smarter than me. They were better looking than me. They were better at sports than me. Turns out that was the one true one. They were actually better at sports than me. And they were hanging out with me as a favor, you know, for my entire life. I'm actually still friends with them, but it's all out of pity, you know. The other six are like glued together because they're, you know, they're gods among men, and I'm this, I don't know, like Igor following them around. That's how I felt. And I didn't play sports, you know. I was very skinny. I had acne, like really oily skin. And when I was in seventh grade, my mother came home from teaching. She's a teacher, and she looked at me on the couch for a minute, and she said, "Matthew, you're not picked first for the team, are you?" You know, with all the love in her heart. And I said, "No, I'm not." And she said, "Would you like to play an instrument?" And I leapt up and said, "I want to play the guitar." And she bought me this really crappy guitar. But, you know, it's what they could afford. That's what they could afford. And I went in my room, and I came out 10 years later, and I own that instrument. I can play the guitar. I made all my acne go away. It made me feel comfortable in my skin. Got me a date with the head cheerleader. But I played guitar alcoholically. I mean, I was obsessed with it. All I could hear was it. My brothers were musicians. My brother was a drummer. My other brother played the bass, and they encouraged it. So it kind of helped me survive my own personality, if that makes any sense. And so anyway, my junior or senior year, I don't remember which, but these six guys and I were at a party. Well, it was the seven of us in a bottle of tequila, and in Catholic school at the party. There were no girls, and since I don't drink, I kind of noticed there were no girls. And but they were taking shots of tequila, and I felt so uncomfortable in my skin. I couldn't take it anymore, being outside. And I got to say, in defense of these guys, they never once pressured me to do anything. But I saw what they were doing, and very quickly I said, you know, I'll have a shot of tequila. And things were really bad with my brother at that time. And I said, I'll have a shot of tequila. And my friend Casey said, oh, great. It was his house. His parents were out of town, a beautiful house overlooking the ocean in Hermosa Beach. And he poured me a shot of tequila, and, you know, this is the part I like describing in an AA meeting. You guys know what happened, right? I took that shot of tequila, and 12 years of Catholic school guilt just melted out of my shoulders, you know. And all my acne was like gone. And I was like, does anybody have a football? And he was very virile, you know. And just, it all came rushing in, you know. I'm here, you know. And I thought, wow, this is why they do this, you know. And I went and got a much bigger glass, bigger even than this glass, and said, can I have some more, please? And they were like, yeah, they were a little worried, but they filled up the glass, and, you know, I was funny and smart, and just, it was great. And it's a big house, there's eight kids in this particular Irish Catholic family, this house. And I had to go to the bathroom because I had a lot of tequila. And I'm walking down, and suddenly this house became like a cruise ship, you know. And I would never have such trouble maneuvering that hall. And I got into the bathroom, and then again, a nice house, I mean, big marble sinks and stuff. And I sit down in the toilet, and you got to remember, I got 12 years of Catholic school in me, and I remember my last thought before I blacked out was, God would not make a body that can defecate and vomit at the same time. That would be an imperfection in God's perfect. And but as many of you know, I was wrong, right? And anybody know that person? Yeah, whatever. Yeah, thank you. One honest man. So I blacked out, lurching towards the sink. And the best part of the story is I woke up on the floor of the bathroom in a sleeping bag with a pillow under my head like I had gone camping. You know, I'm like, and I had no idea why I was there. And I'm breathing fire. My mouth's all weird. And it smells like bleach. You know, and my friends had found me in between functions on the floor. Sure, yeah. Yeah. But alcohol is merciful, and I had no memory of this. And I woke up, and nobody was there, and I was late for school, so I grabbed my backpack, and I got on my bike, and I rode to school along the beach, and I'm riding, and I'm slowly, throughout the day, piecing together what happened. And then I remember what happened. I was filled with shame. And I was shot for cool, and I don't think you can get any less cool than what happened. And I've heard a lot of people speak from the podium and say, I had my first drink, I had that amazing experience, I got sick as a dog, and I couldn't wait to do it again. But what happened to me was I had that shame, and it just slammed up against my brother, you know, in my mind. And I saw my mother constantly worried and in tears, and my father pacing around, and all the money they spent bailing him out of jail and fixing the cars and replacing the stuff he stole. And I just felt like I was going to be him. So I didn't drink again. And it's good to be here in Visalia because you'll understand this. Well, before I tell you that, the summer between my senior year of high school and college, my brother appeared on the porch. And he told my mom and dad that he had 60 days sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he wore out his welcome on a couch, and couldn't take a shower. And he had been living in his car. And they said, if you're 60 days sober, you can live here. And I was so happy that he came home. I mean, we're like, if you ever read any J.D. Salinger, we're like the Glass family. There's no privacy in my family. And I was shaving when he'd be in the bathtub in the morning, and he'd be reading this blue book. And I'm looking at that blue book thinking, that's the magic book. Because we had tried everything. We did group therapy, and it was the 80s. We did tough love, and that's how we ended up in his car. But here he was reading this blue book, and he would say something, and after a while, you realize, hey, he actually has the ability to tell the truth. Because he had, everything he said was a lie. And he was showing up and doing like a lame job at a lame place, and he seemed quiet and humble, and I'm shaving, looking at that book, and wondering what's in that book, you know? And then I went to college, and this is why I'm glad you're from the state. I went to Chico State. And I forgot that I didn't drink, you know? And I forgot I didn't smoke pot and do acid too, but you know. But this is an AA meeting, and I sure hope those headphones are soundproof. So again, and I was off and running, you know? And I graduated, but so 10 years later, I'm 31 years old, and I drank myself out of my career. I was a musician. I got to be a musician, all that practicing. My first love is music. My first love is actually guitar. The first thing I ever fell in love with was the sound of the guitar. It's still true. When I see guitars, and my heart jumps in my chest. I just think there's something between me and that instrument. And I had what everybody wanted. I was touring. We had a record contract. And the man who stands before you was kicked out of a rock and roll band for drinking too much. You know? Need I qualify more, you know? And I didn't think it's funny. I didn't think it was funny at the time. And it was bad at the time. I'd worked all my life for that. I'd practiced. I wrote songs. I developed a skill. I'm very talented. I really am. I mean, that doesn't come from me. That comes from God. So I don't mind telling you. I have natural ability. And I drank away my dream. A dream that so few people get. And I did all the right things. And these guys didn't want to do that to me. They didn't want to get rid of me. But I did every bad thing in the book. And I came back from the East Coast and I lied. I lied. And I told everybody in town that I came back to town and left the band because my mom was dying of cancer. Truth was, my mom was dying of cancer. The lie was, I came home for her. I would have stayed away until after her funeral. Because that's who I was. But it was a good cover for why I came home. And I got this job at this restaurant. It was, I took a job as a waiter at a Marie. You guys have Marie calendars up here? So this one was on Pier Avenue in Hermosa Beach. It's gone now, so I can speak into the tape recording. And I got a job as a waiter thinking, you know, if you're a waiter, you're kind of still an artist. You don't still know what you're going to do, right? And because it was beneath me. You know, I want to be clear about my form of alcoholism. It was beneath me to be a waiter. That's what I thought. And I got this job as a waiter, and then like a day after they hired me, they actually read my application, and they said, dude, you have a minor and a major and a degree, and you sure you want to be a waiter? And I was like, no, I don't want to be a waiter, but I didn't tell them that. And they said, you want to be a manager? We have a management program, and we need a manager here. And I thought, God, that is even lamer than being a waiter, you know? But I owed everybody money, and I said, yeah, okay, I'll be a manager. And I remember like the third or fourth day when I showed up, and they're taking me around the restaurant, and they're like, you know, here's the way we keep track of the dating on the meat, and here's how the cook schedule works. And you know, I knew all the waitresses were like 18 and 19, so that was like one good thing. And then they go, and here are the keys to the bar. Yeah, you guys get it. The guy kept talking, like he had to keep talking, you know. And he's talking about counting money in my office and stuff. And but I just saw like Excalibur, like, you know, like. And I thought, you know, this is perfectly suited for me, this job. It's amazing. Like, it's like, wow, you know. And I was looking at the waitresses and looking at the keys to the bar. And I figured out what was going to happen, you know. And that was my plan. I was going to drink with couple of these waitresses after the restaurant closed and go home with somebody, right? And that happened a few times. But what mostly happened is this actually happened. Two beautiful girls from Manhattan Beach said, hey, you know, we got a hot tub at this apartment we're living at, and we were thinking, this is at the bar after hours, we should go, you know, have a hot tub. And I'm looking at the bar going, well, why would we go? You know what I mean? You know, I could put MTV on, you know, because I didn't want to leave the booth. Yeah. And I had this weird rule, we didn't steal bottles, we just sell shots, you know. Because I didn't want to get caught. And I got caught, and I got fired, and the day I got fired, one of the waitresses came up to me and said she was pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I said. But I like to say I said it with a lot more feeling than he said. And had a depth in me. And now there's a lot of women here, and I'm kind of afraid to go on with this story. But I want to be honest. I want to be honest because there's a lot of people in their first year. And if you lined up the waitresses at Marie Callender's and said, which one do you want to accidentally get pregnant? I would have said, not her. You can all hate me. I just want to be honest. And I'll tell you why. And it's about my alcoholism. Because then there were other waitresses that might be pregnant, you know. But not her because I thought she's 18 years old. I was 31, and I thought she was selfish and self-centered. That's what I... Okay, now you really hate me. I'm really being honest. But I really did. I thought, oh, God, you know, this girl didn't get the right convertible for her birthday. You know, I'm like, you know, she's from the wrong stock. I was 31. I just bombed her life. I just torpedoed her dreams and my feeling. And then they took me up and fired me. They didn't even know about her. And this is funny. They fired me, and I stormed out into the employee parking lot pretending I had a car out there, you know, and I had a car. It might have been on the moon. I didn't know where that car was, but I didn't want to lose face. I didn't want to walk out front of the bus stop. So I walked out, slammed the door, and walked around the whole block and went to the next bus stop down, which ironically is right in front of the Alano Club. Yeah, I didn't know what Alano Club was, and I didn't care. But also right next to it was the Civic Center in Hermosa Beach, and at that Civic Center at that time, they taught young, mentally retarded adults, like 19 to 25-year-olds, how to live on their own. Like, they taught them living skills and how to pay bills and how to move around the city and stuff. And there, when I walked up, I got, you know, snot coming out of my nose. I'm crying. I got my Marie Callender's manager badge on. I got my knit tie. I'm trying to bring those back all by myself. And I walk up, and I'm smiling. I've been drunk for weeks. And there's about 8 or 9 of these young adults who are mentally retarded. Heart is standing there, and I come up to the bus stop, and I'm standing there, and it's on Pacific Coast Highway, and that bus just could not come fast enough. I was so humiliated. So I stepped out of the highway to see when the bus was coming, and 10 mentally retarded people yelled, "Go down in the street! Go down in the street!" And scared the crap out of me. Because I was hallucinating by that time, and I'm like, "Did they just hear a bus? Did I don't see the bus? It's like, is it invisible?" And the truth was, they were better at waiting for a bus than I was. That's a fact. And you know, I got on the bus, and sadly, that was not my bottom. You know, I actually went home, and I tried to drink myself to death. I actually put a gun in my mouth on a regular basis. Because that girl was really pregnant. My mom was really dying. And I was really a loser. I was a barnacle. I was a loathsome person. I did awful things. You know, one of the things that I am ashamed about is that my mother and father were lovely. They were not, I hear a lot of fifth steps, and I know that, you know, there's blood on the walls of Thanksgiving in some of our homes, and that wasn't my experience. My experience was two people that wanted me to succeed with all their hearts. My dad worked till 10 o'clock at night to send me to college, you know. My mom was a school teacher. She had quiet bigness. She was a lovely person. My dad was this boisterous Irish guy who adored my mother. He never followed her. He never insulted her. None of that ball and chain stuff. Every time my mother's name came up, my dad paused and said, "The greatest thing that ever happened to me." And when that girl was 8.5 months pregnant, I pushed her down a flight of stairs. And I didn't do that because I wanted to hurt her. I didn't want to hurt her. I didn't want to hurt that baby. But I want to be honest. I didn't have a feeling in me for them. I couldn't even feel them. I could see them. But nothing came in here. And what happened that day, she wanted me to go to the doctor. And because the baby was coming, and we weren't a couple much, and I was already drinking, and she wanted me to stop. She wanted me not to drink. She didn't realize I'd already started. And I just tried to push her out of the doorway of my apartment, and I could tell as she fell backwards that I pushed her too hard. And I closed the door because I didn't want responsibility for that. And I went inside my house, and I didn't check to see what happened, but I could hear her. And I made a drink. That's what it was like for me. So that was probably May 1st, 1993. And May 14th, 1993, my brother called, a sober brother. He got sober, that guy we kicked out of the house. And he stayed sober when he moved in with his parents. And this was about 12 years after that. And he called me and said, it's Mother's Day, and I'm going to come pick you up, and we'd like you to come. And I didn't know why he thought I wasn't going to come. And you know why he thought I wasn't going to come is because when I would be just barely getting sober, I'd think, God, I want to call my mom. You know, I was sober enough the next day. I'm going to go visit my mom. I love my mom. I had so much respect for her. And I called and said, Mom, I'm going to come visit you. And I thought I was. If you put a gun to my head, I would have said, I'm going to. And my mom said the same thing every time I called. She said, that would be lovely, honey. Every time. Every time. And I'd hang up the phone, and I'd walk towards the door, and I'd catch a glimpse of myself. I weighed 108 pounds in May of 1993. I weigh 168 pounds now. And I thought, you know, I don't have a job. I got this pregnant girlfriend. I don't look so good. I'm just going to have a drink, and just one drink. I'm just going to bring it down a little bit. And if you put a gun to my head and said, are you going to have one drink? I'd say, absolutely. If I have more than one drink, shoot me, because I'm really going to have one. And you guys knew what happened, right? The sun went down, and then the birds started. Because I didn't leave that apartment. I did that probably 20 times. And every time she said, that would be great. So when my brother said, we want to make sure you come, my first thought was, why would he think I'm not coming? You know? Because I'm full of self. I'm full of self. And he came and got me. I stood out in front of the house. I didn't want him to come into my apartment because I had these very special SWAT-proof blankets on the windows. A lot of people don't understand how that keeps the SWAT team out. And I had dishes in the sink from the Reagan administration, you know. And I was into weird stuff. There were bottles on the floor. And I just stayed in there like Gollum. You know, I sat on my couch and held my breath when the mailman came on the porch because I didn't know who that was. So he picked me up and he was startled, and I didn't know why. I didn't know why he was startled. And then he said, let's go. And we drove down to Mother's Day. My dad was arranged for us to go to brunch at this little yacht club called King Harbor Yacht Club in Redondo. And we went in there, and everybody was surprised looking at me. And my dad was all nervous because my mom was really sick. We thought this might be her last Mother's Day. And he started talking, and I started talking, and I wasn't making any sense. And I was trying to talk so they wouldn't stare at me. And slowly they locked me out of the circle. Slowly they stopped looking at me. And you know, I've had so many moments of bitter and incomprehensible demoralization because of alcoholism. I have had so many. I've done things to other people that I never thought I'd do to another human being. And I told you just one of them. And I've let things be done to me that I never thought I'd let be done to me just to get loaded, you know. And at that moment when my mom and my dad and my brothers and my sister turned me out of that family was the worst one, and I don't know why. I mean, if you saw the movie, you'd go, that wasn't the worst one. Remember that? I mean, but, you know, I was in the movie, and I was in here, and that was the worst one. I was the youngest at 4 in an Irish Catholic family. Everybody loved me. Everybody rooted for me. Everybody celebrated my victories. And they just couldn't stand the sight of me. And my brother drove me home, and we got in an argument. Neither one of us knows what it was about. It was not about my condition, oddly enough. And I was so mad at him. And I love this, too. I love alcoholics, man. We are just phenomenal, you know. I slammed the door of his car, and I went in the house because I wanted to win the argument. So I was going to wait till he got home and make my points, right? He's sober. He's visiting my mom. He's raising a family. He's got a job. He's not a man. I'm hiding in my apartment. I failed at everything. I've hurt human beings in ways they will never get over. They will never get better from things I've done for them. And I thought I was going to win this argument. And he got home, I called him up, and I just screamed at him. You know, yeah, I'm making all my points, and I'm sure it made a lot of sense. And when I got done, he didn't say anything. It wasn't really a dialogue, you know. I just said what I needed to say. And when I got quiet, he was really quiet, and he said into the phone, "Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcoholism." And I think the next moment, not that moment, but the next moment is the moment of grace in my life. A moment of grace is, the definition of grace is an unwarranted gift. It usually has a spiritual component to it. And I think this is the moment of grace because my brother said that, and the moment of grace came when I said back to him, "Of course I do." Because I never said that. I've been walked away from, you know, fiancés by their parents going, "Dude, you're not marrying her. You know, you're a drunk." I've been kicked out of bands. I've lost money for important people who tried to keep me sober so I could help them. I lost jobs that were beneath me. Lots of people have said, "You need help." And I said, "I'm not an alcoholic. My brother lived in his car. That's an alcoholic. I'm a rock star. I have a degree with honors. I always pull it out at the last minute. That's how I did things." But here I was, 108 pounds, locked out of the family, sitting on that couch every day, waiting for this baby to come with a gun in my mouth. And he says, "You have a problem with alcoholism." And I don't know why, but I said, "Of course I do." I think God hit my back and I coughed. That's what I think happened. Because I can tell you what the carpet looked like with the light coming through the Venetian blinds that moment. It was a turning point in my life. And it was the first step. I didn't know it was the first. I admitted. I didn't know that. And the next thing is the funniest thing anyone's ever said to me. My brother said, "Don't go anywhere." I was like, "Oh, okay, you know. Gonna have to clear my calendar, you know. It's gonna be tough. You got a minute? I gotta call the president." I hadn't gone anywhere in 7 months. Sat on that couch. There was a liquor store right next door. There was a pawn shop 2 blocks away. I had no guitars. I was drunk. All my babies were gone. And he came over. I thought he was going to come over and just want to tell the truth. I've told this story a million times, but it's what I was thinking. I thought my brother was going to come over and kick my ass and I'd never drink again. Because sometimes that's how things went down in my house with my brothers and me, you know. And you know, I think some of you might understand this. I kind of hoped that's what he was going to do. Because as bad as my life was on the outside, and it was bad. I've described to you really just the teeny tip of the iceberg of how bad it was. It was a moonscape. I owed tens of thousands of dollars. I had warrants out for my arrest. I had burned nice people and bad people, and I had done a lot of bad things. But it was 10,000 times uglier in here. I couldn't even go up here. That's why I had to stay loaded. But down in here, it was a cesspool. So I kind of hoped someone would kick my ass. And he didn't. He came into my apartment and said, "Let's go to the beach." I lived right next to the beach. He later said, "Your apartment smelled so bad, I couldn't stand it." And I grabbed, I don't know why, this is such an important detail to me, but I grabbed 2 packs of Marlboro Reds. A pack and a half. I smoked some of those. And I took him down. I guess it's important because I took him down to the lifeguard stand. And he sat right across from me in the lifeguard stand at Avenue A in Redondo. And I sat there. And I started smoking cigarettes. And he started talking to me about how he felt when my mom and dad kicked him out of our house when he was 18. And I remember that day because I was 11. And it was a awful day. We didn't do that in my family, but we had had enough. And he started describing to me how he felt when his wife and son said, "No more. You cannot come around us anymore." And I remember that day because I was about 14 and he called me on the phone because he had nobody in the world to call but his little brother. And he was sobbing. "What have I done? How do I fix this?" And then he started describing to me how he felt when he was living in his car. And I remember that because I was 16 years old. I used to drive around in my car, my dad's car, on my way to school, and I'd try to find his car. And if I found it in a parking lot at the YMCA, or sometimes he parked behind the school, I'd go up and look in there and see if he was breathing, because I loved him. I knew he was dying. And right in the middle of describing how he felt during all that, he described exactly how I felt. And I didn't think anybody knew how I felt. And the last guy I would have picked was him. And he just, and I calmed down a little. I was smoking, and he's talking, and I realized I'd run out of cigarettes. That's a lot of cigarettes. When you're 108 pounds, that much nicotine is almost should kill you, you know. But I needed something all the time. I needed something all the time, particularly if you're there, you know. And I couldn't drink there. So I'm smoking, and I'd love to tell you I had a moment of clarity, but my moment of clarity is he's going to keep talking, and I'm out of cigarettes. That's what, really, I just want to be honest. I want to be honest, you know. We're not heroes here. We're sick. We got help from God. And I looked at him and I said, hey man, you know, you're right. I should go to AA. And he was like this perfect Buddha, wise man. And all of a sudden, that guy disappeared and my sarcastic Irish Catholic brother came back. And he looked at me, kind of focused at me, and he laughed. He went, dude, you're not going to AA. You're going to a hospital. And I looked at him and I thought for a minute. I said, man, I can't do that. I'm busy. You know, and the saddest part, anybody remember how busy we were? You know, yeah. I really thought I was busy. That's the funniest part, is it was not an excuse, it was a fact, you know. And I don't, what am I thinking? Like, who's not going to pay the bills of my apartment? I'm the guy not paying the bills of that apartment, you know. Who's not going to answer the phone? I'm the guy that doesn't answer the phone. And on the way up to the apartment, we're walking up, and he looked right over my head when I was telling him I was busy. He didn't even listen. And what he was doing was he was figuring out how quickly he could get me into rehab because he was terrified. And I didn't know. And we walked up, and as we walked up to my porch, he looked at me and he sent a chill down my spine. He said, don't die. And I thought he knew about the guns. And I was embarrassed. He didn't know about the gun. I was dying right in front of him. So I kept staring at that gun, trying to figure out how he figured that out. And on May 16th, 1993, I woke up. I'd been up May 15th getting ready for rehab, you know. And, right, I don't want to be a loser at rehab, you know. Like, show up, like, I'm one of you. And, I'm such a, I don't do things half-assed. And the phone rang, and I picked it up, thinking it was him. It's the only reason I answered that phone, and it was not him. It was some woman. In fact, I used to say I didn't know who this woman was, but I met her a month ago, 18 years later. And she said, hey, we've been looking for you. Your daughter was born today. And I apparently couldn't hear the phone. I was too deeply blacked out. And she said, can you come to the hospital? I said, of course I can. I jumped up and I had these OR hospital pants. Remember we used to wear those? You guys wear those? Like gray scrubs back in the 90s or late 80s, early 90s. And I had a t-shirt on, I had a hole in it, and I had flip-flops on, and I ran out into the blinding sunlight with a hell of a hangover, and I went looking for my car because I had to go to the hospital. And I was running around looking for my car, and I finally found my car. And, you know, they say alcoholics are selfish and self-centered, and I think this is such a great example of that. I got in my car and I went to the hospital where I was born. Because that's where babies come from, right? You know. I went directly to Little Company of Mary and they're like, we have no idea what you're talking about. And all 108 pounds of me was livid, you know. And I'm smashing my hand and they're like, you can do that all day. There is nobody here by that name. And but we think on the first floor there's an outpatient program. And I go, oh, whoa. And they got that all covered, you know. And I ran back to my car, and in my car I sat there and I remembered Anna had told me a million times where the hospital, where she was being born. I just didn't listen to her ever. And I got in my car and I went to the right hospital and I walked up and it was more polite and I asked where they were and they told me what room and I didn't think. You know, I didn't think about it. And I got in the elevator, I went to the right floor and I was looking at the numbers and I was not preparing myself. And I turned the corner into the room and there Anna was. And she was happy to see me. And I've never felt more humiliated or embarrassed in my life, because the last time I saw that girl, I was pushing her down a flight of stairs. And she got up and was beaming at me. And she started coming across the room. And I thought she was going to hug me. And I realized how badly I smelled. And I didn't want her to touch me. And she was coming at me. And she stopped. And I thought, thank God. And she turned to this rectangular glass thing. And she lifted out of this thing an angel of God. An angel of God. Phoebe Rose. And she said, this is our daughter, Phoebe Rose. And she put this little baby in my arms, and I looked at her, and she was pure and beautiful, undescribable, perfect little everything, clear, and I was so filthy, and she was so clean, and I was so evil, and she was so innocent. It was not a good thing. It was maybe the worst moment of my life. I know that's awful to say, but I want to be honest. It was bad. It wasn't good. And I lied. I lied to Anna, and I said, everything's going to be fine. And what I was praying, I prayed very loudly to myself, I hope these two women never see me again, because I'm going to hurt them. And I'm not going to mean to do it. I'm not even going to be thinking about it. And something bad's going to happen. And they're out of my league. And I walked away, and I was going back to that gun. I was going back to plan A. I'm going to drink myself into a stupor and blow my brains out. And I got to my house, and my brother was waiting on my porch, totally bumming my high, you know. Because I had my plan, my individual solo isolator plan. And there he was, and he goes, where have you been, you know? And I said, I was at the hospital. My daughter was born. He didn't say, is she healthy? Congratulations. How's Anna? He looked very sad. He didn't think it was such a great thing. He said, get in the car and pack the bag. That was my last drink. So we drove off to a hospital. Scariest day of my life, right? Going into that hospital. I don't know any of those people. I don't have my medicine. Who knows what the second scariest day was? Walking out of the hospital. Thank you, Katie. That's exactly right. Because now I got to go out here, and all my best friends in the world who I've known for 28 days are not coming, you know. And my brother drove me home, and he pushed me out of the car, and he said, go to a meeting. And I remember thinking, go to a meeting? These AA guys, wow, you know. I got 30 days, man. I got a brand new baby. I got a mom that's not long for the world. I owe a lot of people money. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to visit Anna all today. You know, I'm going to visit Anna. I'm going to go see mom. Go to a meeting. You've got to be kidding me, you know. You know, newcomers are with the AA guys. Like, wow, you know. So I walk up to my porch, and I unlock my front door, and somebody hands me a beer. Actually, it wasn't a beer, it was a Coors. I always say that because it was such a disappointment. And I put this beer in my hand, I looked at it, and I looked at them, and they were snorting cocaine off the glass table and smoking pot, and there were a bunch of people there. And the weirdest part was I lived there all by myself. And nobody visited me while I was there, you know. But I put that beer down, and I ran away from my own house. And if you're new here, there's a lot of people in their first year. I want to be really honest about that. I want to be really clear. I did not have a moment of clarity. I didn't have spiritual foundation from my four or five steps in the hospital. What I saw was very clearly to me is I have nothing. I have no self-respect. I have no character. I have no really family ties that have survived this. I have no friends. I have no dignity, but I got 30 days. And I'm not losing 30 days on these clowns. And I put out the only reason. And all I had in the world was 30 days. So I ran to a phone booth. A lot of young people here. They were like glass. And they're rectangular things. And they were like, it's almost impossible. They had these phones that were the size of small missiles. And another thing, young people don't, we had change back then. We didn't have credit cards, and we put it in there. And I looked up AA, and I got to tell you, this is just funny. You know, I have a degree in literature, a minor in religious studies, and I couldn't find AA in the phone book. True. I was like looking in the back, thinking it's embarrassing, right? It's got to be in the back. And it turns out it's way in the front, and right next to Aardvark. I called the guy at AA, and the poor guy in AA, I told him, like, I've been talking for 30 minutes. I told him everything I told you guys so far. He was like, oh, I'm sorry, baby, it looks really good. And my mom's dead, of course, you know. And Because I wanted this guy's help, and I thought he had to get to know me, you know. I really wanted help. And he said the greatest thing. He goes, yeah, where are you? You know. And I mentioned these cubicles are made of glass, and I looked out the window, and I said, I'm on Burl, and what street was that? And I told him, and he flipped through these papers like a heron on the phone. He said, God, that's so weird. And I go, what? And he goes, there's a meeting right across the street from you. It's going to start in about 15 minutes. You know what I said? What do you think I should do? You know, I want to help, you know. I'm like, that's great, you guys are getting together, but I need some shit now. Now, you know. And I was hoping for a furnished apartment and a nice, you know, bath of iced tea. And he was so great, he goes, you should go to the meeting? And, so I thought, wow, this is so winning. And I walked across the street and I was afraid. I actually walked around the block. I didn't know you. I didn't want to go in there. People were laughing in there, you know. Actually, they weren't. I got there a little early, but I went in and I sat down in the chair in the middle of this big speaker meeting like this, and you know, the guy got up to the podium and he was wearing a suit, and I'm just sitting there with static in my head. And the guy got up. I'll never forget what the speaker said. I'll never forget it. He put his hands on the podium really calmly and he said, "Wah wah 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 wah." Wah, 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 wah. And you're all laughing and nudging each other, and I'm like, I am so screwed, you know. Can't even hear him. And, I love anybody's musician, but if a B3 organ has what's called a Leslie speaker, and it spins around, and that's what my head was like. It was like a Leslie. If you weren't like catching me talking about me when I was spinning by, I couldn't even hear you, you know. And the reason I know this is because I'm a sponsor, and when you talk to newcomers, they're almost visibly their eyes, you know, and then you say their name, and they go, Then you go to God and the steps, and they're like this again, So I went to that meeting, I left that meeting, at the end of it, as soon as it was over, I remember the guy pointed to the steps, he said, these are tools for living, and I'm like, why are they in Chinese, you know? What? You know, like, I need the cop step and the tax step and those steps, like the baby changing steps. I need tools, you know. And so as soon as the meeting was over, I started to leave, and one of my brother's friends, I didn't know, one of his friends from AA said, hey, aren't you Matthew M? And I said, yeah. And he goes, wow. He said, wow, I heard you look like shit. And I had gained 47 pounds in the hospital. Yeah, and I said, well, that was 30 days ago. And he said, well, can I give you a ride home? I go, man, that'd be great. I ran here. And we walked outside, and we're walking out to his car, and I start to slow down, right? And he's walking, and I'm slowing down. And he's walking, and he turns around and goes, what's your problem? And I go, well, I don't think I have a home, you know. And I told him about the beer and the cocaine and the pot. And he thought for a second, he said, hey, don't your parents live like right near here? And I said, yeah, they live like a mile over that hill. He said, well, I could take you there. And I said, no, man, you can't take me there. And I want to talk to anybody in your first couple years of sobriety, because I so wish somebody had said this to me. I just didn't know this. There was my perception of reality. It was over here. And in my perception of reality, I was 31 years old. I had a teenage mother of an illegitimate child across the town. Just got out of rehab. My mom and dad were married at that time for 45 years. They were madly in love with each other. Their loser son isn't going to show up on their porch tonight. That's the worst possible thing that could happen to them. It's humiliating to them. They have enough to deal with. Most embarrassing thing that could happen to me. That was my perception. So the guy dropped me off at my parents' house. Because you guys just don't listen. And you know what was weird is I knocked on the door and my dad opened the door and he was happy to see me. Really happy. And my mom was smiling.
really short hair from chemo, and she's looking at me, she's beaming at me. And the reality was, over here, they've been married for 45 years, they're madly in love with each other. My mom's really going to die. And the one guy they worried about just showed up, and he looked okay. And he asked for help, and that's all they ever wanted me to do. And I stayed with them. And I saw things happen in that house that were just so beautiful. My mom was deteriorating, and my dad was so afraid that my mom comforted him with her loving heart to tell him how strong he was, how capable he was, how he was going to be okay. That's love on a graduate level that I've never seen before. I just wanted to pay attention. They never mentioned my sins. They never brought them up, not one time. That's love. It was perfect. It was perfect. That's reality. That's reality. You know how much my perception counts? Not at all. You know how your sponsor doesn't seem to be listening to you sometimes? He's not. He doesn't want to hear it. It has no effect. It's over here in this box. He's gradually moving you over here, where it's always rich and beautiful and profound. Always. Always. And the game here is, how do I lose these dark glasses? How do I lose all this crap that's come between me and this higher power that I'm afraid of? So, I got to tell you a bunch of stuff about being sober, and I'm going to fail. My first, I promised God I'd tell this story a long time ago if I ever got a chance to do it. Now I've told this story so many times I might kill myself. But I was like 90 days sober, and I was walking with my sponsor into a meeting. And I said, you know what, man? I can't believe how much I love Phoebe Rose. She's 3 months old, right? I said, I thought it was the worst possible thing that could happen to me. Worst possible thing. But it's the best thing. I'm a sober dad. I mean, she's taught me things. I feel motivated. I feel alive every day. And he didn't say anything. He just walked into the meeting. It was so weird. And I walked into the meeting. My thought was, I did not realize he was deaf in his left ear. You know? I should be more attentive to him. He's handicapped. And I watched him across the room because, you know, I'm self-centered and aggrandizing. And I'm like, wow, I didn't get through to him. And he's not looking at me at all. And we walk out that same day. We're walking out his car after the meeting. And I'm going, hey, man, maybe he didn't hear me. I'm talking to his right ear. And I go, but, you know, I love this little girl more than I love myself. And he turns around. He put his hand up. And he said, Matthew, how much child support do you pay? And I said, you know, I live with my mom and my dad. I work from midnight to 4 a.m. at a loading dock. I get up at 7, I go deliver packages, and I go to 3 meetings a day. And he said, no, I'm very aware of all those things. How many child support do you pay? So I don't pay any. And he said, then you're completely full of it, aren't you? And I went, what? And he said, this is a program of action. He goes, it's not a program of talk. He said, you go to a gazillion meetings a week. You must know that by now. He said, I got an idea. Why don't you not tell me ever again that you love your daughter and just show me and I'll know. We had a really quiet drive back to my turn. I was planning his death and he was living in the present moment. And I got out of the car and I went into, it's really hard, you know, I got moved into my old bedroom at my parents' house, my old bedroom. I had been there for 10 years, and there I still had my Clapton poster on the wall, and so I had to go in there to have my righteous indignation moment, you know. That's hard to hold on to, you know. I'm pacing around my room talking to Eric about it, this unsensitive boob that I have to be my sponsor, and clearly I need to get another sponsor because he's not sensitive to me, and and about the third or fourth turn around the room, Eric and I realized that the reason I was red-faced is because he was right. He was right. I was full of it. I was trying to convince somebody that I loved something, and I didn't give any action. There was no action about that love. I don't lift a finger for that.
So I called Anna instead, who turned out, by the way, to be the exact right girl to get pregnant in Marie County. What a mom. What an amazing mom. A selfless mom. I called Anna and I said, you know, I should give you some money. She said, oh my God, that'd be so great. And I said, well, I don't make much, but I could give. She said, well, wait, wait. She said, I don't name an amount. She said, well, I'll just get a percentage of your paycheck. Anna's real smart, too. And I went, okay. And she named a really reasonable amount of money. Now, I was never going to leave my parents' house. Remember when you were new and you're like, I'll just stay here and be happy to your husband for free. Lame job, lame car, lame house. I'm good. And I didn't know it was going to get phenomenally better. I just knew I wasn't drinking anymore. And that drinking's hell for me. And that's why I paid that child support. I want to be super honest. I paid that every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks. I had never missed. Every 2 weeks. In fact, I'm done. 18 years. Every 2 weeks I did it. And I want to tell you why. I did it for two reasons. The first reason was I never want to drink alcohol again. And I am personally powerless over that happening to me. And my sponsor has this weird voodoo of making it seem like if I don't do what he says, I'm going to go right to a bar, you know. And so I thought, don't drink, you know, don't pay child support, end up drunk. And that's the first reason. And the second reason was much more personal. And that reason was that the only spiritual experience I had in my first year of sobriety was holding C.B. Rose. Because I was uncomfortable all the time. I didn't like myself. I didn't like you. You were irritating because you knew you didn't like me too. And she was just this clear-eyed thing that would pull on my face, and she was so open to me. She just loved me. She didn't care. And I would hold her, and she smelled so good. And her head would just rub against me. And I thought, if I go to that house where those parents of that teenage girl are, and I pay this money, I can walk by them with my head up high. I can walk by them with my head up high. So I paid the ticket. That's why I did it. Those are the reasons. I did it every 2 weeks, every 2 weeks, every 2 weeks. And what I noticed was I'd walk in, L.A. has a lot of big meetings, and I'd walk in these meetings and people would see me and they didn't burst into applause. You know? And I thought that was weird. And I got the grapevine. I'm looking at the grapevine going, where's the Matthew Pace Child Support? He's a hell of a guy article. And you know, you guys didn't know. You didn't know I paid child support. And you know what became super important is that you didn't know. And I did it anyway. Every 2 weeks, every 2 weeks, every 2 weeks. I went on panels, I worked the steps, I did my first step. Every 2 weeks I paid that money. And for the first year I had to stop by the, hey loser, cash your check here and we get half of it because you have a lousy credit score to get the money to go pay the child support. You know that place that was up here, right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. A friend of mine went to one place.
And I paid that money, and you know what? Like after a year, I remember this day, Anna was going to go to college. She just fought her way through that. Single mom or not, she's going to do what she's going to do. And she's going to go to college, and I'm playing with Phoebe, and I'm going, yeah, Phoebe, I'm your dad. I'm going to take you to your first day of kindergarten. I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade, and second and third and fourth and fifth, and all the way. I'm going to buy you a car when you're in high school. I'm going to try to make it so you can go to college. I'm going to be your dad, little girl, for the rest of your life. Isn't that amazing? It dawned on me that I had a lifetime relationship with this girl. A year before that, I prayed that they never see me again. And that was the righteous prayer. That really was. I did not want to hurt them. But I did these things. I paid this money. I did those steps. And I got a little cleaner inside. Not a lot. I never got washed. I got enough to go to the next thing, to get more, to go to the next thing. So I was sliding over at work and at my home and in my heart and in the meetings into reality. And reality was being Phoebe's dad was the biggest honor of my life. And it was super clear. And you know what? I took her to her first day of kindergarten. I took her to her first day of first grade, second, third, fourth, fifth. In fact, Anna's husband and I took her to a new school in fifth grade. They moved to the little neighborhood, moved over one, and he had a baby and I had one of my babies, and we're walking with Phoebe, and we just spontaneously went,
I want another baby. He said, we can't afford this one. I said, I want another one. Your mommy's like this. And she's like, hey, guys, shut up. You know, so Stevie's got a head on her shoulders. Guess where I'm taking her tomorrow morning? Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
Right
on! You know? And I will never retire because I'm also paying for it. And I bought her a car when she was 16. When she was 16 and three quarters, she ran into a tree, and I haven't bought her another one since. But I did all those things, and I had that journey, and it's impossible to say what happens here. But I will tell you this. I got to tell you a couple of the things. I have a feeling, because there's some people here who've heard the tapes, that I want to tell a certain story that's really important in my sobriety. But I want to talk about that for a minute. You know, I sponsor a lot of people. And when they come up to me, I've heard this a dozen times. I got on my 8-step list, I put myself first because I clearly hurt myself the worst. You know, and I'm full of sarcasm. I'm Irish. And I look at them, and what comes out of my mouth against my will is I always say, hey, you know what, man? Why don't we put you at the bottom? And then you make all those other amends. You may find it's no longer necessary to make amends to yourself. It will be done. Because they're all for you. They're all amends to you. It's a spiritual path that restores you. And it's, in my experience, I would have got $15,000. It seemed like $10 million. In fact, I got to tell you that story. I would have got $15,000. I ripped him off. He was paying the rent of that apartment. I was lying to him, stealing from him. And when I wrote that on my 8-step, I said to my sponsor, I can't pay this guy. And he said, why not? And I go, well, I own $10 million. It seemed like $10 million. I owed everybody. I didn't have a good job and living with my folks. And he said, well, what do you think? You got to go to his house with a briefcase? And I go, well, I don't know. What do I have to do? And he goes, well, where does he live? And I said, well, right now he lives in Mexico City, but he'll be back someday. And he goes, well, how much, if he stopped you on the street today, how much could you give him? And I said, I don't know, like $10. And he goes, all right, write him a letter, send him $10. I said, okay, did you hear me though? I owe him $15,000. And he goes, yeah, no, I know. So I wrote him a letter, and it was a really long letter. It was really carefully crafted. And then my sponsor got a hold of it, and it became a really short letter. And with all those self-justification parts got whisked away, And I sent him $10. And every month I sent him $10, and sometimes I'd send him $20, and sometimes I'd send him $50, and I got a better job, and I sent him $80 and $100, and sometimes I wouldn't send him any at all. But I kept track, because when I'm paying you back, I keep track, When I'm ripping you off, I'm like, yeah, it's about $15,000, But when I'm paying you back, I have paid you $233.14 today. So I paid him $7,000 over 7 years. And he called me and he said, look, he moved back to the United States, lived in Laguna Beach. He said, man, stop sending me these checks. And I go, well, why would I do that? And he goes, well, I don't know what's going on with you. And he goes, but I receive these letters and I've met you a few times. He goes, you're a good husband, you're a good father, you're a good son. You're a really contributing member of society. You're a joy to be around. You have paid me back. But I made the mistake of calling my sponsor. To brag. I want to tell you guys that never, never good. Don't brag to the sponsor. And he's so cool. He goes, wow, really? Wow, really? He said, that's that guy you started paying back when you lived with your mom and dad and you worked at that newspaper. I said, yeah, and he goes, man, now you got this great life. He goes, hey, man, if you want to stop doing what's working, that's cool. That was an $8,000 phone call. And, those payphones, they don't even take $8,000. And so I called him back and kind of stuttered, gotta pay you back. And he's like, I don't know, whatever. And then my dad died after my mom died. My mom died in my arms. I was holding my mother in my arms. And we were clean. And I was her son. And it was exactly the right thing to happen. It wasn't a horrible moment. It was a spiritual experience. And about a year later, my dad died of a broken heart. He left me some money. And I knew what to do. I wrote a check for $8,000. And I sent it to Larry, and I want to tell you this story because this is a true AA story.
Larry called me up and he said, "Wow, you're not going to believe this." He said, "I'm sitting here looking at my wife, Wendy. We just found out that we're pregnant, and we've been trying to buy this house we're renting, and we've been about $8,000 short of a down payment." And the check turned out. The loser, the flake, the animal, got to help a guy with perfect credit buy a house.
You know, with his own money. Whatever, you know.
My sponsor once shouted, "With his own money!" You know. So I kind of hear him every time I tell that story. It just kind of deflates the story, don't you think? So anyway, I got better jobs, I got this job at the airport at an airline. And I got to buy a guitar one day. I was solvent enough to afford a guitar. And I bought a really nice guitar. I bought a Taylor Dan Curry model acoustic guitar. And if you play guitar, you're jealous of me. That's okay, because I have self-esteem. And I got off the bus and I ran into work. I was a few minutes late. I put the guitar in my locker. I went into work and I worked at the airline, and then at 10 o'clock, the way that works at Los Angeles International Airport is the employees go out and they catch what's called the D-bus to the parking lot. So I went out to the D-bus stand, and this brand new, if you're a guitar player, you understand this, just the case was romantic, you know. It was brand new, it had a big gold Taylor sign on it, and I'm like, it was like having a magic trick with me. And I'm standing at this bus stop, and I turn to the first person standing next to me, and I go, "Hey," it was this woman, I go, "Hey, can I show you my new guitar?" And she had a British Airways uniform on, and she turned to me and she goes, "I can look at strange men's guitars." And I'm like, ooh. And she gets on the bus, and I get on the bus after her, and unfortunately for her, the bus was full. And we were pressed against each other with this guitar case between us. And she had a book in her hand. And I realized she was uncomfortable, so I looked at the book, and it was called Surprised by Joy by C.S. Lewis. And I said, "Hey, I've read that book." And she goes, "Well, cut to the chase. Do you believe in God?"
Oh.
And I said, "God saved my life, you know." Bad pickup line number two. And all the blood drained out of her face. And she was like, "Please let me disappear, please." And I said, "Well, do you believe in God?" And she said, "I'm on the fence. I'm kind of exploring this stuff. I'm taking a class." And we had this really calm conversation about spirituality. And I didn't tell her I was an alcoholic, and I didn't tell her about AA. I just talked about God. And while we're talking, I'm looking at her, and she's just beautiful. She has blue eyes, and there's this long, thin neck, and short, dark hair. She looks like Audrey Hepburn. And she has this amazing accent. And I'm like a uber Beatles fan. So I'm listening to her going, I just want to fall into her accent. She said the word water, and I almost went weak in the knees. Ask a British person to say water. I won't try to do it. But so we had this conversation. I'm realizing how lovely she is. And the second realization is I'm pretty relaxed. And that didn't happen. Beautiful women need relaxed. That didn't happen. And we got off the bus, and I said, "Hey, maybe we could forget about this guitar and have, you know, dinner sometime." And she didn't think so. She was like, "Oh, right, I read that book. Look at my guitar." She goes, "Yeah, I got to wait to get this bus every night. It's not okay to hit on a blah, 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 blah." And I'm like, "You could have just said no, you know." And she walks away. I wonder if I should say this, but I knew that I had grown spiritually because I went to work the next day and I didn't tell anybody at the airport that she was a lesbian. Because that's her business, right? I mean, I'm okay, you're okay, we're okay, you know. Actually, I told that story once at the Pacific Palisades, and this woman came up to me and she said, "Matthew, I'm a lesbian." And I said, "Oh, really?" And she said, "No, how I know?" And I go, "No, how do you know?" And she goes, "I'm not attracted to you." I'm helping women discover their sexuality. You know? It's like the reverse of the 13th step, I guess. But I'm not really kidding. The point was, I went to work the next day, and I just felt sad that I made her uncomfortable because she seemed like a nice person. But you know what? I like me. I'm clean inside now. I'm really clean inside. And I'm good with me. I'm just sad that I lost the chance because I said the wrong thing and made her think I was hitting on her, and I was not. I really sincerely, innocently wanted someone to look at my guitar. That's all I want. And I only thought about her like 50 times maybe that day. Like hardly at all. And then we got out of work, and I went to the bus stop and played bus stop. And then I was like, oh, God. And I thought, well, I don't have a guitar. Maybe she won't recognize me. And I thought, maybe she's not going to make this bus because they come every 15 minutes. And she came walking right up next to me. I could see her out of the corner of my eye, and I got real tense, you know. And she came up, and she tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know what? I think I might have been rude to you last night. I don't want to go out with you, she said, but I'll have coffee with you if you want to miss this bus. You want to go to Starbucks here. And on July 27th, we celebrated 15 years of marriage.
Come on! A guy converts a lesbian and he goes, miracles happen here.
You know, my wife, Philippa, is beautiful, and one of the earmarks of that romance when I first met her, and when she proposed to me 3 weeks after that bus ride, because I'm not taking no with you. You know, we had a lot of coffee, and so she's like, you know, we could go to dinner, and I'm like, oh, really? But she's, you know, doesn't need me. You know, when we were falling in love with each other, one of the things that was different for me is she didn't need me. She just wanted to be with me. She was perfectly self-sufficient. I used to tell my sponsor, you know, she's not blonde, she's not anorexic, she's not addicted to heroin, she's really not my type, you know. And he said, yeah, right, you change, and when you change, and when you grow, and when you open yourself up to the sunlight of the Spirit, you attract people of better quality. And I thought, wow, this could happen here? The important thing in my sobriety was I went to my sponsor about the 11th step, and I said, you know, I don't understand this. Pray for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. I don't get that. Because I was raised Catholic, and I was afraid of God. I didn't think God liked me. I know that's not the Catholic Church, but that was my experience. But God didn't like me. I remember Sister Dennis Ann looked at me when I was 14 years old, and there were all these hormones pumping into me, and she goes, if you're thinking about sex, you're going to hell. I was like, oh, shit, you know, I'm going to hell. And then I looked around the room, and I knew every guy in the room. I'm like, God, it's going to be so crowded. But the point is that I didn't like, I couldn't be good enough for that God. I was impossible. I didn't know it was impossible. I tried to be good like that, and then I did bad things. And knew God hated me, and I was full of shame. And by the time I got here, I really did bad things. Really bad things. And God should hate me. So when I got to that part about how do you know God's will for you, that's too ambiguous. And my sponsor waited a while, and when he answered me, he said, you know what, man? I think you're making this too complicated. He goes, I think when the alarm clock goes off, that's God saying, yeah. He said, when a bill comes in the mail and says, pay this amount, God's going, hey, let's pay that amount. You know, when Phoebe's diaper needs changing, God said, let's change the baby. He said, you know, it's the next indicated thing. It's the next indicated thing. That's God's will. Just do the next indicated thing. And it opened up my life. It's why I have better jobs all the time. It's why I have a better life. I just do what's in front of me. And if you're, a guy came up to me once after a meeting, he goes, well, what's the opposite of the next indicated thing? I said, your grandiose plan. That's what I'm always doing. My grandiose plan. So when I went to Mary Philippa, my mom was still alive, and she said, let's go to Chicago. Let's go to Crystal Lake, Illinois, where your mom's from, and get married there so she has a chance to go home before she dies. That's the woman I married. It wasn't about her at all. Not at all. It was about my mother, who she loved. And we went to Crystal Lake, and we have this little tiny house on a lot of property, and it goes right up to the lake. And I walked out onto that pier, and I stood on that pier, and I looked up in the clouds, and I said, thank you, God, that this is the next indicated thing. How cool is this? This woman who's way out of my league is going to marry herself to me today. And my mom's here, and my brothers are here, and my sister's here. It's awesome. Because the next indicated thing isn't always a dirty diaper, you know. It isn't always a bill or an alarm clock. Sometimes the next indicated thing, many, many times, the next indicated thing makes your heart blow up in your chest with joy and sublime. I've had it over and over. I could spend another hour telling you moments of sublime. Just highlights, 18 years of wow. But I want to be honest. And I hear a lot of speakers. I'm really fortunate. I get to go all over the world. And I want to be honest. people come up to these podiums and they act like we get sober and life gets better and it never gets worse. It just gets better and it never gets worse. And you know, my mom died in my arms. My father died right in front of me. I've had good jobs and I've had bad jobs. When we were married for 4.5 years or five and a half years, I came home and I found Philippa on the ground. And she had a massive stroke. And Philippa's never ever going to be the same again. She's brain damaged and she's paralyzed. She's incapable of a lot of things. She's dependent. I have to dress her. I have to change her. I have to help her in the shower. And I'm not lying to you when I tell you that I can't believe my good luck. I'm not lying. I don't want anyone else. I want her. But she's not supposed to be anywhere else. This is just bullshit. Over here, I have intimacy with someone. Like, I have intimacy faster. People get married, they stay married 40, 50 years to get what I've got with her. She doesn't want me to help her. She allows me to help her. This woman changed my standards. She taught me what a good man I could be. She showed me the world through the eyes of someone who didn't feel filthy all the time. How lucky am I? I get to take care of her. She still gives me great advice. I'm just not sure she knows what she's saying. I'm like, really? Is that which side of your brain? She gives me lovely children. If you get a chance, go by and gaze at Sophie. She's stunning. No, look at my nose, man. Didn't get it from me. We have this little tribe, you know? Phoebe, Rory, and Sophie. And we do our thing. I'm going to finish with this. There's a lie that we tell people around Alcoholics Anonymous. It really freaks me out when I hear this. And the lie is, we walk up to a new guy and say, you new? They say, yeah. We go, everything is going to be all right. That's a lie, you know. So if anyone told you that, they're lying. But they're not meaning to be lying. The truth is that things are going to be what things are going to be. You know, when you get sober, you're just like, you know, normies have bad stuff happen. It's not, well, we're sober, we're special, nothing bad's ever going to happen. Things are going to be what things are going to be. Usually there's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with my wife being brain damaged and paralyzed. There's nothing wrong with it. It is not wrong. In reality, it's vibrant, it's alive, it's true. Would we wish it on anyone? No, of course not. Are we accepting of it? Absolutely. You know, my wife told me a couple days ago, we went for a walk at the beach, and it's a slow walk with her. She said, you know, I've forgiven it. I've forgiven the stroke. It's taught me how to overcome. I've had so many amazing things happen because of this situation. I've had so many moments of heart-stopping truth. There's nothing wrong. The things aren't going to be all right. But the good news is you're going to be all right, no matter what, if you do this stuff. And if you clear away that stuff that blocks you from the sunlight of the Spirit, and there's 12 suggestions on how to do that, and I've never seen them fail. Thanks, Lord.
Yeah!